Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In the struggle to prevent the Pacific Northwest from becoming an export hub for fossil fuels, Native American tribes have played a vanguard role in taking on the fossil fuel industry. This morning on Locus Focus, we look at how the tribes are an inspiration to everyone who has joined the campaign to stop oil, coal, and LNG terminals, pipelines, and trains from wreaking havoc on the culture, community, and environment of our region. My guest is Paul Lumney, Executive Director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. Paul, welcome to Locus Focus.
Good morning.
About a month ago, there was a press conference at City Hall in the wake of the Mosier oil train explosion, and you were one of many people that spoke along with the mayor and other luminaries. Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me, as I talked to you a couple of weeks later, that as all the elected officials were thanking everybody, the first responders and everybody who'd come to the forefront of dealing with the mess that Union Pacific made of the Mosier area on June 3rd, that he didn't mention the tribes. And I wondered, what was that about? And what is your response when every environmental activist that I talk to is always talking about what a major role the tribes have played in trying to stop oil trains and oil terminals and all the kinds of facilities that are being proposed for this region?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was pretty awkward for me because I'm sitting there, a representative of a community of color who often deals with issues of being invisible, and I was standing right in front of them. And I know that they have speech writers and they had prepared remarks, but whoever was putting their remarks together forgot to mention the tribes. And I thought it was unfortunate because we were first responders. We were there right away, and we cared about the river more than just about anybody there trying to get samples. It took us a long time to even get samples of the water, but we were there with the community from beginning to end. The very next day, I was at Mosier for the rally put on by the Columbia River Keeper, and was a real strong supporter of their work, as well as stopping the fossil fuel industry from destroying the Columbia River Gorge.
Well, the tribes have had a long and perhaps checkered history in trying to stop the abuse of the Columbia River, which has been your home for thousands and thousands of years. And when we were talking in July, we were comparing the previous degradations against the Columbia River, in particular all the hydropower dams that have gone up since the early 1930s, with what's happening now. And you mentioned that there's a big difference between the way the tribes are organized, perhaps, and see themselves now and the way they did 50, 60 years ago. So I want to talk about what has changed from the time when basically the dams came in and destroyed fisheries, Indian fisheries, up and down the Columbia River, to what's happening now. And an example, this is not exactly in the Columbia River, but up north near Bellingham, the Lummi Nation was successful in stopping a coal terminal to be built at Cherry Point because of the importance and vitality of their fishing rights, which the Army Corps of Engineers even understood. So how do you see this transition from being a time when Indian fishing rights and all the other rights and treaty rights that you were granted 150 years ago were basically ignored to now where they're actually setting precedent to stop these projects?
Mm-hmm. Good question. The tribes in the Pacific Northwest, many of them anyway, signed treaties with the United States government in 1855. In that language is the reserved right to fish and hunt, as well as gathering roots and berries. And those are our first foods. The Creator gave us these gifts, these first foods, these sacrifices. And if we take care of them, they'll always take care of us. That grounds us as Indian people. Unfortunately, though, since the treaties were signed in 1855, it's been a downward spiral of constant attacks on the environment that have affected the fish. I would say probably in the turn of the century, early 1900s, is when the tribes were really beginning their struggle for survival. And it continued all the way into the 50s and 60s, well past even the dam building era. It continued into the 70s. But we were not lucky or not successful until the late 1960s with the first major court ruling to guarantee the right of a fair share of the fish. That was the U.S. view. Oregon court case, followed by U.S. v. Washington in 1974, which even defined it further, as well as protecting the habitat for the fish. So what has changed now compared to back then is that the tribes are much more organized. We sought out coalitions to support our causes over time, and we also have a federal government that is much more respectful of their trust responsibility to the tribes. So while many entities, including government entities, have taken advantage of the tribes, it's much harder now. And so when the tribes started to see all of these fossil fuel transportation proposals to the gorge, we got very alarmed and started looking at them and thinking, oh my God, these are going to go on over and over and over again. We started putting together a list and keeping track of the status of them. And we quickly came to the conclusion there's no way that we can stop these on our own. We have to reach out to the community. So we started reaching out to the environmental community. We started reaching out to the religious community and any community that lives along the railroads. And we found that there was a huge groundswell of support to work together. So I'm really pleased also with that effort, as well as all the tribes up and down the coast. They've all started working together more collaboratively, too.
So were you among the very first people to recognize that there was this major threat that was looming with all these proposed fossil fuel development projects?
I don't know if we were the first, but we saw it early on for sure. I think the first major scare was the liquefied natural gas proposal. And it was a big company, very dangerous factory that would move this material through, potentially causing enormous explosions. And we had to do everything we can do to stop it, and we did. And we couldn't have done it alone. We did it with a lot of community support.
Actually, we just did a show on that last week, and I talked with Lori Kaplan, who was one of the two leaders of the group that stopped the liquid natural gas terminal, which was originally going to be an export terminal, and then no, it was supposed to be an import terminal, and then it was changed into an export terminal. But they saved the community of Astoria and that whole area, the mouth of the Columbia River, and that's a fascinating story. And there was also like a coalition of a whole lot of groups, including the fishermen. But I think that the tribal presence there didn't make it as clearly upriver to Portland as clearly as I've seen the incredible presence and vocalism of the tribes in fighting the facilities that are here in Vancouver and this stretch of the Columbia River. And I'm curious about what kind of role you played with stopping the LNG terminal and the two terminals in Astoria.
Well, that was primarily a coalition effort, pooling our resources, everybody recognizing that no one entity could do this alone, but we could, working together, affect the outcome, and we did. And so that was a very big success that really did more than just stop that proposal. It actually empowered us all to continue to work together to stop all of these other proposals for coal and oil transportation to the Columbia River Gorge. Now, I grew up on the river, fishing on the Columbia River, and we never saw these kinds of oil trains coming through and kind of coal trains coming through. We never saw it like that. We saw big trains, and the trains are dangerous because we sometimes get hit and killed by them while we're trying to get to the river just to go fishing. But to have these dangerous materials coming through at such an alarming increase woke everybody up. And not just the fishermen on the river, it also caused a great concern by the tribal governments at all levels.
Well, I know that, we talked about this too, that there's sometimes a split between the tribal governments and the tribal people over issues. But is this a situation where the tribal governments are in close alignment with the base, the other members of the tribe?
Oh, they're definitely on the same page. I think everybody wishes we could do more, and we are doing everything we can. I'm convinced of the tribal governments having their attention, that they really care and will do anything they can to stop it. I've seen that on a couple of proposals now. The one at Port of Morrow, which is a coal transfer facility, they were going to put coal on a barge, and we stepped forward with our legal proceedings. We intervened and filed affidavits. That facility has been stopped.
And what were the grounds on which you filed against that facility?
That was because we have a fishing right there, right in the area where the facility is being proposed. And the state of Oregon, in their decision-making process, stopped it based on that particular reason.
So that's very similar to how the Lummi Nation stopped the Cherry Point coal facility.
Exactly. And that, which I've been to several times, I'm very well connected with the Lummi people. I'm married a Lummi. So I go up there.
Very connected.
Yes, very connected. And I've been there at the site, both on the river and on land where it is proposed. And it would have been just a disaster to see that kind of a facility. It would have destroyed an ancient fishing and township of the tribe there, as well as the current fishing grounds. It's a very most productive, most sought-after fishing area of the Lummi Nation.
Well, actually, when we look at the Columbia River, I mean, there's fishing rights up and down the river from Astoria, probably all the way up to, at this point, the Grand Coulee Dam, because you can't fish much above the Grand Coulee Dam anymore. But I'm wondering if this is something that gives the tribes a lot of clout in terms of what can be developed now on the banks or in the center channels of the Columbia River.
Well, I don't know if clout is the right word, but certainly causes these permitting processes to pause and reconsider the presence of tribal fishing in the area. I don't want you to think that tribes can just go out there and throw their treaty right on the table and start going through legal proceedings. That is a very difficult choice to make, and that's one that only tribal governments can do. Because what if there's a bad decision, and if you end up pushing that all the way up the chain through the court system, it could eventually go to the Supreme Court, and we're not very confident right now as we were several decades ago on the kind of ruling we might get out of the Supreme Court. So I don't want you to think that I am promoting the tribes to put their treaty rights out that way. That's a tribal government decision. But when they have done it, it's been successful.
So what is the process? I mean, when does the tribal government decide that this is the direction we're going to take to try to stop this project?
I think that all of the proposals are under review, and we are commenting on them through regular processes, and we're being treated differently as governments. So we're allowed to come in and have a different kind of a status in the public, which is good. Because tribes are not stakeholders, we're not members of the public, we are governments. So that's good. We're getting some different kind of standing there. But
so this is actually government-to-government dealings that you have between the tribes and the United States government.
Yeah, and various other governments at different levels too.
So how is that different? I mean, because that's what I see, is that that's actually what kind of gives you more say, more power than just an environmental group that's coming in and taking a stand against one of these projects.
I think we have a different kind of leverage. Everybody has their own kind of leverage, and so you try to use yours to the extent that you feel comfortable doing, and the tribes have been successful so far. There are other groups out there that have a lot of leverage too, the religious community, the environmental community, anybody that has a small town next to a rail line is, or in a big town, they have leverage too. In fact, I was in Spokane just a couple of weeks ago and saw on their front page that they've passed an ordinance making it illegal to move train cars through downtown Spokane, and they're going to levy a fine. I believe it was around $261 per car. Now, I don't know how successful they will be, but wouldn't that be amazing if every city along the corridor did the same thing? Well, that would be great.
I'm thinking as Portland did a kind of feel-good resolution like that last November, which was, we don't want rail trains going through our community, but we don't have any say about it, so we're just saying this. There's no teeth to it. And when I read about the Spokane resolution, I was like, well, how are they going to enforce this? Do you have any idea, like, what they do to make... Because it seems in the wake of Mosier that we realize even the United States government doesn't have a say over what the railroads do. The railroads are king here.
Yeah, I don't know. I asked some of the lawyers in my office what they thought, and the first thing they said was they wanted to see the legal reasoning and the legal opinions of the city, how they thought they could be successful. And the reason why we haven't gotten that far is because we were really involved in the DeSero Savage proceeding for the oil transfer. And in fact, I'm calling it a trial because it was sort of, it was treated like a trial. And I testified and was on the stand for about an hour and a half. And that was going on right during that time frame. So we just haven't had a chance to look at the legal opinion on that.
Jack, I want to get to that because I think that's that's something we haven't talked about yet since the last time I talked to you. But if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Paul Lumley, who's the executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, who a group that has been very vocal and very in the forefront of working to stop the whole array of, what are there, like 18 or 20 fossil fuel development proposals in the Northwest that have been floated. Many of them are in the permitting stage, and in the eyes of a lot of people, quite a few of them have already gone down. So I was very curious about that, the Siting Council, the trial that you described that you were at and testifying for. What, let's talk a little bit, we should, for people who've just never listened to the show before and you don't know what the Tesoro Savage Vancouver Oil Terminal is about. Let's talk a little bit about that and then what the meeting that you were at was doing.
Sure. Well, Tesoro Savage, that's the name of two different companies, and they have come together to move oil through the Columbia River Gorge to a site in Vancouver, downtown Vancouver, Washington, down by the riverfront, and make it the largest rail-to-ship transfer station anywhere, I believe, on the continent. And it would move about over 20 trains through the gorge per week, about 28 is my estimate. And we currently have about 14 per week, so this would triple it. And so we are very concerned about, at least from a tribal standpoint, not only the transfer of the oil through the Columbia River Gorge, but also the transfer station itself, where it'll go onto big barges and be shipped out to the sea. And any one of those locations up and down the river, there could be a disaster. And so Washington State is dealing with the permitting process, and they have what's called the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, FSEC is their acronym, and they are in charge with hearing information on all sides, from the permittee to the opponents, about their proposal. And they conducted it very much like a trial with a judge. And then they had this council that sat there, and they heard all this information for over a month. And then at the end of this month, there'll be closing arguments, and then they'll go into their process for a deliberation and make a recommendation to the governor of Washington State, where then he will make a decision on what to do with that proposal.
So I heard from people who were there that the testimony was overwhelmingly opposed to the terminal. Was that your impression from being up there?
Well, I heard from all sides on that, and the tribes offered up 11 different expert witnesses. I was one of them, but they certainly have their proponents on their side, and I will be very blunt and tell you that one of their primary proponents there they put as a witness was exaggerating quite a bit about what a low risk it would be for these oil trains and to come through. And I took great issue with that before the FSEC, the whole Site Evaluation Council, because, well, for one thing, that we already have 14 trains per week, right? And one blew up at Mosier on it was June 3rd, I think it was, a couple months ago. And so now we're going to triple it. And he concludes that it's a very low risk, very doubtful. Very doubtful. And also implying that because we have mitigation, habitat mitigation, whenever there's a disaster, the tribes would be better off with the mitigation because we'd have more habitat for the fish. So he was saying that we'd be better off with the spill. It was outrageous.
Now, I saw mention of that. Now, what were they saying and how do you parse that?
I think he said just that.
They really said that after the spill, when they mitigate, they'll make things better than it was before the spill?
Yeah.
Had they been down to Louisiana since the BP oil explosion?
Well, I can name you probably 10 right off the top of my head where we're not better off. Let's start with the Columbia River dams. Okay,
yeah,
that's one.
Mitigation, fish ladders, not quite the same as having...
Well, you know, I do a lot of work with Bonneville Power Administration and the Northwest Power and Conservation Council on their mitigation program, so I'm not criticizing the good work that they do. We sometimes have challenges, but it's nowhere near the kind of mitigation that the tribes deserve for the salmon that were lost. We used to have somewhere around 16 million on average coming back this every year. Now we have a couple million if we're lucky. And we're nowhere near mitigation, nowhere near it.
I think it's a very good lesson. One of the things that when I think about the dams compared to these oil terminals, and it might just be, it's like what you're used to. When I came to Oregon, the dams were already there, and it took me a while to, like, it took me a number of years to really learn what the landscape was like before the dams went in. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, oh, is this a good idea? Maybe it wasn't such a great idea. Do we really need this electricity? But the other part of the dams is that they supply abundant and relatively inexpensive and relatively clean electricity for this region. I'm not sure how much knowledge there was before they put the dams in of what it was going to do to the fish. I'm not sure how much of it was just ignorance and how much of it was malice or not caring or whatever. But with the oil infrastructure that is being proposed, there seems to be a big difference in terms of the cost benefits of it. And I wonder how you see that, that if there's what makes you, in fact, maybe even more alarmed by the oil and LNG and gold projects than you would have been by the dam building.
Well, I think they were both thinking that they could get through with this permit process without having anybody like Tribe step forward. I think they thought that we'll just deal with it. And a lot of people that are putting these proposals through for coal and oil transportation, they don't live here. They don't care. I hear about these discussions that, well, maybe the Columbia River Gorge should be just this sacrifice area that, yeah, there's going to be some disasters there, and it's just a sacrifice zone. And that's just unacceptable. It's outrageous that people would even say that. If it was their home, their backyard, they would never allow this. They wouldn't want us to go to their front yard or their beautiful homes and start sprinkling coal in their front yard, although maybe somebody should. But I just tell them what it's like, because, you know, I go up and down the Columbia Gorge, I see coal all over the tracks. It just comes right out of the cars. We had a disaster already. These are not things that they care about, obviously, or they wouldn't propose it. And I just don't see why somebody should have to die just so they can get rich. I don't see why an ecosystem has to be wrecked just so somebody can get rich. We have to stick together and stop these proposals, especially the Tesoro Savage proposal.
Well, I was talking with Jared Larrabee, who's the communications director for Tesoro Savage, for Vancouver Energy, which is the local name for this supposed local organization that's running it. And he lives, I guess, in Vancouver. He's telling me how much he loves going hiking in the gorge. In fact, he wanted to know some good hikes I could recommend to him. And how could he possibly want to do something that would destroy the gorge? I had the conversation with him, I think, on June 2nd. Mm-hmm. And the next day, when the oil train derailed in Mosier, I wonder what he's thinking now. Because the other part of it was like, we will do everything possible to make sure that nothing bad would happen, because it wouldn't be in our interests. So, to me, I don't know what the disconnect is, but I haven't talked to, actually, I emailed Jared right after the oil train derailment and asked him for a statement, and he passed me on to the railroads because it wasn't there. They said, we're sending first responders whatever we can, but this is not really our purview. This is not our responsibility. So I find that kind of interesting, too, that the company that would be the reason why all these trains are going through the gorge pushes it off on the railroads. It's really their responsibility if there's any kind of disaster.
Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a lot of finger pointing every time there is a disaster. The Mosier accident, the oil didn't get in the river, and it was contained. It was very close to the river.
A little bit of it got in the river.
Yeah, a very little compared to what it would have been if it actually spilled all their contents in the river, or much less like a barge that breaks in half in the lower Columbia. But, you know, there could be some pretty serious disasters. And, you know, when I was at that site evaluation hearing, the questions were, you know, what is the risk of an accident? And I was thinking, you know, that's the wrong question. The question should be, how many accidents are we going to have over a period of time? What is it going to be like for the environment when it's trying to recover from one accident and then there's another one and another one? And what is it going to mean for the communities along the Columbia River living in danger zones like this? Will they want to stay there? What's it going to mean to the property values when you have, you know, multiple accidents? So the question shouldn't be if there's going to be an accident. It's really how many are there going to be?
Well, another thing that concerned me is where we draw the line. After the Mosier accident, the first thing that the governors and even our senators were saying was, we need to stop the oil trains going through the gorge until the cause of this accident is determined. And other people, including the people who live in Mosier, saying, we have to stop the oil trains going through the gorge, period. Mm-hmm. And then that became, I think, the battle cry of the Department of Transportation in Oregon after a while. They kind of got it. And so we're calling for an end to all oil train passage through the gorge. But then at the city hall press conference that you were at, along with all the elected officials, Charlie Hales was saying that oil trains, there's other ways to transport oil. We don't need to do it in trains. Trains is a really bad way. Barges are much safer. Trucks are safer. And I was kind of standing there with my jaw dropping, like going, what does this mean? And I saw two issues that I had with it. One is, I don't know that barges are a terribly safe way to transport oil. And the second part of it is, from Mr. Climate Change champion that Charlie Hales is, I think, trying to be in the last days of his being a mayor, doesn't he want to keep the oil in the ground? So I'm wondering, as we're speaking for yourself and also speaking for the tribes, do you see that there's a difference in the way that the oil is transported? Are you concerned that all these different methods of transporting oil are all dangerous?
I'd say they're all dangerous. And we've experienced different kinds of disasters from all these different kinds of transportation. Barging is very dangerous for our fishery. You know, I fished in the Columbia, nearly hit by barges on a couple of different occasions. Trains are obviously dangerous for a number of reasons. We get hit by them. People have died just by being hit by them. So increasing that traffic is not good. And we've had truck accidents that have dumped some pretty nasty contaminants into our rivers, too, that have harmed the environment. So I think the best proposal is just what you said, leave it in the ground. There's no question about it.
Well, actually, a number of years ago, I had an opportunity to ride a barge from the Bonneville Dam to the Dalles Dam. And the barge was carrying... I was riding a tugboat, and that was pushing three barges. And one barge was empty. It was going to be dropped off at the Dalles for Cargill to fill up with wheat. One of the barges was carrying Vancouver's garbage upriver to where it's dumped. Mm-hmm. And the third barge was carrying oil. And I walked across all the barges, and it was a real toss-up, which was the one I wanted to be on less, the garbage barge or the oil barge. And my thought is, when you can smell fumes, that means that the volatile compounds that are inside this barge are getting out. And so when you're barging oil in the river, some amount of that oil must be actually going into the river if I'm able to smell it standing on top of the barge. Do you think that's true?
I've never been on a barge, but I take your word for it. I know when an oil train goes by, you can smell it too. And when a coal train goes by, there's coal that comes out of the top of the cars. And it's not dust. People say, oh, we spray, for the dust. But it's actually chunks of coal that come out. And it's all over the tracks in some locations. I took some photographs and showed a representative from a railroad company and showed him all the coal. You could dig down as deep as your hand, pull up all kinds of coal everywhere, even in the water. And his first response was, oh, so you're trespassing. Which was pretty crazy. I mean, I have this proof that there's a problem out there, a natural disaster that's already occurred, and it hasn't even been a train accident. But they went out with this big machine and vacuumed it up in the area where I showed the photographs. But I was out there a few weeks ago. It's starting to come out of the train cars again. You can see it everywhere.
Actually, I was having this image in Louisiana where they're trying to rebuild the they're trying to rebuild the wetlands that are all disappearing very rapidly. And so they were sucking up sand and spill. I mean, I'm not sure where the sand was coming from. Anyway, they were sucking it up and they were pouring it to rebuild the wetlands. And this place is an area where there's a big coal terminal that's right across the way. Mm-hmm. And a reporter was there watching this process and saw that there were these big chunks of coal that were coming out of the hoses that were depositing the sand. They were basically depositing coal chunks into what they were trying to rebuild wetlands. And it was because this coal that was being piled up at the terminal across the way just gets everywhere. And it was very bad PR for both the wetland mitigation project.
Sounds bad, yeah.
And I think that to me, couple times I've been down in Louisiana, it's really a wake-up reminder of what it's like to live in a petrostate and what it's like to be living in an environment that's completely dominated by the petrochemical industry. I don't know, have you spent any time in places like this? Do you have a sense of like how much this would really transform the Northwest if these places were built?
Well, any community that is transformed into an energy corridor is going to see some dramatic changes in everybody's way of life. There'll be no question about it. I wouldn't recommend it. I have been down there, not necessarily to explore the oil industry, but I've been down there not too long after the hurricane hit and did some work out there with housing quite a long time ago in another career of mine. But, the way these companies deal with cleanup is not thorough and good enough. They're going to clean it so good enough and according to their standards. And the environment is affected for a long time. It takes sometimes decades for recovery to occur. And we just don't have that kind of luxury here in the Pacific Northwest. You know, we were talking about the dams and mitigation. Well, there's a big lawsuit about that right now. And this oil proposal in Vancouver wasn't included as part of the baseline. And the judge in that court case, as well as the federal agencies, everybody involved in that litigation you know, it's not included. What happens if there's a major catastrophe with oil on the river? It's not a part of the baseline. And if this
so what do you mean by it's not part of the baseline? The baseline for what?
Environmental baseline, you know, because they have to decide, make a decision. Okay, we're going to make the habitat better for the fish according to this environmental baseline that we have right now. But the baseline is changing with this proposal. I think it's a serious question out there. Is if this goes through, it's gonna people are going to have to ask questions. Are we better off for the fish? Even with all this mitigation, if there's going to be a couple of trains that, you know, that crash every once in a while and spill their oil in the river, you're not going to be able to recover salmon runs that way.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Paul Lumley, who is the director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, and we're talking about the tribe's role in stopping the proposals to build vast, massive oil, LNG, and coal terminals up and down the Columbia River. You mentioned that the hearing that you were at this past month, they're going to be making, this body's going to be making a recommendation to Governor Jay Inslee, who will be making the decision finally on whether the Tesoro Savage plant terminal's built or not. Do you know the timing, how long it's going to take before Governor Inslee makes his decision?
I don't know the answer to that. I hope the question's posed to him right away. I was reading not too long ago that the Attorney General for Washington State has come out and said that this proposal doesn't make sense and opposes it. And so, the committee has essentially three choices: to recommend the permit go through as written, to deny the permit, or to recommend it with changes. And I don't know where they're going to be, but I cannot see them pushing this proposal through unchanged, at least. Our strongest desire is that it's just plain denied, and that's a recommendation to the governor. But if it's recommended with changes, we'll have to take a look at it, and hopefully the governor will make the right decision. And I call on all of your listeners here to reach out to the governor's office when that decision is made to make sure your voices are heard.
So it seems, I look at all the opposition, it's ranging from just about every community on both sides of the Columbia River, from actually from Astoria to, well, definitely to Hood River and beyond, and on Washington side as well. And then, like, really strong opposition within the city of Vancouver and very strong opposition within Portland. I'm trying to imagine how the governor could take all that into consideration and listen and hear from his attorney general and still approve this, especially after what he said after the Mosier explosion, where he was pretty strongly coming up very strongly about how oil trains shouldn't be going through the gorge. So in your sense of trying to read this guy's mind, do you have any, if you look at what he said, do you see any way to correlate or predict what you hope he might actually decide?
Well, I don't know him. I've met him a few times. Seems like a really nice guy, but he is a politician, and politicians look at things differently than you and I would do. If we were making a decision about what to do with the home that we live in, it'd be different if you had a whole group of other people telling you what to do. We don't usually have that, but he does. And so we cannot be complacent, even though it looks like there's a real clear reasoning to deny this. But we cannot assume that that's what he's going to decide. And it is his decision. So I think our biggest enemy right now would be complacency.
Now, the other body that plays a big role is the Port Commission of Vancouver, which is an interesting body. Have you gone to their meetings and testified at the Port Commission meetings?
No, I haven't.
Because, I mean, you're familiar with the Port Commission and how it's divided. So for listeners who haven't spent much time at the Vancouver Port Commission hearings, there's one commissioner who is a climate change denier. There's one commissioner who is a very strong opponent of the Tesoro Savage oil terminal and ran on and defeated a proponent of the oil terminal in the most recent election. And then there's a third commissioner who is kind of in the middle. He's the swing vote, so to speak. And so far, his swung vote has been going with the climate change denier. So that's another place where people have been putting a lot of pressure for a long time. But at the same time that the press conference in City Hall was going on last month, the Port Commission was having a meeting where Eric LeBrant, who's the opponent to the terminal, made a motion to deny the permit, just shut down the, and this was in the wake of the Mosier fires, right after the Mosier fire, and people from Mosier were in attendance, and I think the fire chief of Mosier had testified. And people were really excited. I talked to Dan Sears from Columbia Riverkeeper, and he thought it's about the plug's about to be pulled. And at the end of the press conference, I went up to him and said, well, did it happen? He said, no, they couldn't even get it to go to a vote. Oh. So this is like a really problematic body. But I'm wondering, do you know if the tribes are putting pressure on the Port Commission as well? Because they could at any moment deny this permit and it'd be all over.
They could, yeah. I haven't been as involved as some of the folks in my office who have been, and the coalition certainly is involved. But my focus has been on the Energy Site Evaluation Committee. That's primarily been my focus. So, and I have never really attended any of their meetings, but I have heard the scenario that you described many times. And how can, I question, how can three people be put in such a critical role? It's just mind-boggling that they would have that kind of power.
Well, we shouldn't be so smug here in Portland, because our poor commission, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if we have a climate change denier on it, mm-hmm. but it's, again, the poor commission just a year ago was proposing this huge, it was going to be the largest liquid propane terminal in North America to be sited in Portland, right across
Pembina?
Pembina, right. Mm-hmm. And it was the poor commissioner and a couple members of the city council, including Charlie Hales, who were supporting it. And all of a sudden, 180 degrees, Charlie Hales pulls away from it, and it's dead. But it was an interesting process. But I think if the port had its way around Pembina, it would have gone through. So I think that up and down the region and probably all across the United States, there's these port commissions that are just like wanting to do all this development that is not in the interest of the communities. Mm-hmm. And the port commissions are not really made accountable to the communities. Vancouver is one of the few places where I'm seeing that the accountability is starting to happen. So
good.
I think
good.
That's another place where we can.
I remember I was in my office. It was, I want to say, around maybe 11 o'clock in the morning. And I get a call from the Umatilla Nation. And they said, Paul, we need you to go down to a hearing with the city. They're saying they've consulted with the tribes on Pembina. And they haven't. So you need to go down there and tell them they didn't do it. So I went down there and they were all surprised. I said, well, we've got the guy in the room here that did the consultation. And it was an employee of Pembina. And he just mailed brochures to the four tribes, and that's what he called consultation. Well, obviously the city didn't really have a grasp on what consultation was. But I will say, though, that they just hired a tribal liaison for the city, and I'm so excited about that. And I wish Patricia Gibson all the best, and I look forward to working for her. She's starting today, actually, and hopefully the city and the tribal relations will improve. It was already fairly good. It just, they really fumbled several times.
Well, the tribe's going to smell a whole lot of brochures to the city now. Let them know.
You know, another thing that really frosted me, if you don't mind me saying that word, at that hearing was the cleanup plan in case there was a disaster. They were going to use the federal sites on the river that the tribes use for access to the river. They were going to put the booms out to collect the oil on our fishing villages. And that was their cleanup plan. And they never bothered to ask us. So they're going to turn our fishing villages into a collection zone and cause all kinds of contamination. It was just outrageous. I also learned that the booms that they're going to put out to collect the oil don't work in high waves. And everyone knows in the Columbia River Gorge is a lot of wave action. So, there's some misinformation out there on their side about their abilities to clean up if there's a disaster. And it all came out in the hearing.
So you're talking about now that the cleanup boom areas are, this is for the Tesoro Savage
mm-hmm,
plant.
Mm-hmm.
So this wasn't Pembina.
Sorry, I switched topics. But Tesoro Savage, all these companies, they think, oh, we'll just clean it up. And they don't really realize who's affected and the environment that is affected. All of these proposals, I'm looking at the sheet of paper, there must be about 20 here on this page in varying degrees of permitting, and I don't think any of them have any kind of well-thought-out cleanup plan if there was ever a disaster.
Well, it kind of reminds me of another issue that the tribes were very involved with, which was fighting the megaloads that were going to be going through Oregon, Idaho, and Montana on mm-hmm. their way up to the tar sands in Alberta a couple years ago. And so the route that they're going to take through Idaho is Highway 12, this windy, circuitous, narrow road right along the Clearwater and Loxosaro Rivers in a very pristine, mm-hmm. Wild and scenic area. And several people I talked to said, well, this map, this was decided by somebody in Houston who looked at a map, had no idea of the landscape, and just drew the shortest line. Oh, Highway 12, that looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's maybe the mentality about a lot of this, that they're not looking at the Columbia River and seeing where the fishing villages are. They're looking at the Columbia River and seeing, perhaps they're thinking these are deep water ports or something that mm-hmm. they can deal with.
Very privileged thinking on their part. And, you know, I'm not a rich person. I'm sure these folks are and want to get richer. And they really just don't care, obviously, about how to succeed, but they're going to do everything they can to succeed. And it's up to us to stop it.
So how can listeners support your efforts to maintain our region as a region that's free from the fossil fuel industry?
Well, I think each and every one of these proposals, especially the big ones, we have to coalesce together. And we've shown that when we stick together, we succeed in stopping these proposals. We saw it with the proposal that the Lummi Nation fought off. We saw it with the Port of Morrow up in the upper part of our fishing area. The tribes stopped that. We do have a right to fish in the area of Vancouver, Washington, where that facility is going to be built, as well as every location up and down the river. And that could have a very big sway on the proposal too. But if we all stick together using our own leverage, we can stop these proposals.
Well, Paul, it's really great to have you on Locus Focus. Mm-hmm. Good to talk to you, and we'll stay in touch about keeping up the good fight.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.
Sure. We've been talking this morning with Paul Lumley, who is the executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KWU Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, you would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week we'll talk about if cities can be sustainable with Tom Prue, who's a senior researcher with the World Watch Institute. My engineer is Natasha Delapine. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Ulani. Thanks for listening.
To our elders who teach us of our creation and our past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come, we are the land.
This is dedicated to our relatives before us, thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492.
To those who have kept their homelands, and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today.
To the ones who survived the relocations and the ones who died along the way.
To those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people.
To those who left their communities by force or by choice and through generations no longer know who they are.
To those who search and never find. To those that turn away the so-called non-accepted. To those that bring us together and to those living outside keeping touch, the voice for many.
To those that make it back to live and fight the struggles of their people, to those that give up and those who do not care, to those who abuse themselves and others, and those who revive again, to those who are physically, mentally, or spiritually incapable by accident or by birth,
to those who seek strength in our spirituality and ways of life, and those who exploit it, even our own.
To those who fall for the lies and join the dividing lines that keep us fighting amongst each other.
To the outsiders who step in, good or bad, and those of us who don't know better.
To the leaders and prisoners of war, politics, crime, race, and religion, innocent or guilty.
To the young, the old, the living, and the dead.
To our brothers and sisters and all living things across Mother Earth,
and her beauty we've destroyed and denied the honor that the Creator has given each individual.
The truth that lies in our hearts.